Thank you. Good evening. My great-great-grandparents were African-American slaves in the state of New Jersey. They were freed and migrated to Susquehanna County, Pennsylvania. And they worshipped at the Berry Street African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church, the church where Reverend Jemaine Wesley Logan himself spent a great deal of time teaching the Word of God and ushering freedom finders to safety. And I would like to believe that in 1850, my great-great-grandparents, at one time or another, were in the company of the great Reverend Logan. One day, a little bit over 200 years ago, a lovely child, near to the age of 7 or so and of pure African blood, I do believe, was playing in a meadow somewhere in Ohio. The sky was blue, the grass was green, and all was well when suddenly a white-skinned hand, white beneath sweat and grime and foul smell, was thrust across this child's mouth. A second brutal hand snatched her up and thrust her into a covered wagon, loaded with other horrified little children, black and brown and stolen little girls and boys, too scared to perhaps to cry aloud. They were transported just that way somehow across the river, the wide Ohio River, and down into what was becoming the state of Tennessee, and sold from that vile wagon door to door as little slaves. How and why did this happen, you ask? Because some folk believed this country was being made by and for themselves only. Little Jane had been this poor thing's name, and a family, the John Logue family, he a former something in the Revolutionary War, was thusly granted a good piece of land near the present-day locale of Nashville before he died, John Logue. This happened. He left his wife and daughters and three ruffian sons to manage the land and a factory for whiskey, where sadly and eventually the three sons in particular were nearly their own best consumers. Upon trading money for little Jane from the wagon of doom, the black market door-to-door wagon of flesh, the Logues, in those first few moments, cooed and coddled the crying child to stop her from weeping and trembling until she revealed how she had been ripped from nearly her own backyard. She only wanted to go back home. For that sin, she was chastised, severely beaten with a strap, and sworn forever to secrecy. Do not ever repeat such a tale to a soul. And they changed Jane's name to Cherry, and her youth and life and identity from thence were never more. And Jane or Cherry became the slave child of the home, the land, and the crude whiskey distillery. And just a few years later, David Logue, the youngest son of John, took on the blossoming Cherry. After all, he owned her. He took her adolescent beauty, and she bore her master's children. How or why, you may ask in horror, if such is unfamiliar to you. If you did not know this was commonplace, it's because some folk believed this country was made for and by themselves. Cherry had David's son, and affectionately she called him Jarm, short for Jemaine. And now and again they found favor, as young Jarm was unmistakably the child of his father, and Cherry was worth her weight in gold. A steadfast, tireless work machine. But with time and trials and much consumption of the whiskey, any semblance of familiar grace from David Logue soon fell off to the wayside. Before Jarm's own adolescence, his heart was all too heavy with worry and rage. He'd witnessed countless and senseless episodes of his mother being brutalized at the hands of his flesh and blood uncles. And on occasion, his own father, if so moved, would strike and draw blood from Cherry's brow, until David Logue sold Cherry and Jermaine and the other children of his own seed. This after David had fallen onto ragged times and a pitiful state, after years of gross mismanagement, aided by the alcohol. He desired to take a wife proper, to have a Christian marriage and raise himself a real family. Cherry and his children were like so many horses and cows and pigs for X amount of dollars, sold from the homestead of the Logues. And perhaps to ease his conscience, if indeed he'd ever had one, David sold his colored family to Manasseh Logue. Perhaps they'd fare somewhat better, going deeper into Tennessee to a known hell with the oldest and most brutal brother, Manasseh, than into the hands of cruel strangers. And all of this could and did happen because some folk really believed the country was made by and for them, and anything else contrary to their wants and needs and greed be damned. That young Jermaine lived to adulthood is itself a miracle, because of, or perhaps in spite of, a firsthand witness to injustice and oppression. He became what we now fondly call him, the Underground Railroad and Freedom King, freeing hundreds and hundreds of human beings and agitating against American hypocrisy. Excuse me. Our Jermaine Wesley Logan of Syracuse held up a mirror and a candle to all men to see and be God's children, to not only be free and equal and educated and warm and fed, but to be lovers of the unlovable. And it was perhaps when his dear friend was bludgeoned and deliberately tied to a barrel and kicked until he rolled and drowned in a pond, that's when Jarm first planted the seeds in his heart and mind for freedom. He would have to leave his dear mother, who would later break in spirit and mind after finding her own children, her other children, Jarm's siblings, being led away down the dirt road in a coffle of other slave children being poked and prodded like so many mules and for sale upon the front yard of Manasseh Logue. Jermaine would almost lose his own life and mind while breaking the laws of this land he stole himself away. He nearly died from nature's elements, near starving to death. He was nearly captured and often had no idea where he was going except for being free. Finally, he stood alone and penniless, but free in Canada, where he, to divorce himself from the family of Logues, put an N to the end of his name, hence Logan, and as a near-grown man, learned to read and write the alphabet. Why did all of this have to happen? And I've spared you, believe me, the dreadful details, because some folk believe that this country was made by and for them alone. And in this very city, the good reverend opened his doors and his home to maggot-infested, frozen, and starving finders of freedom. He defied man's law for God's while he was still labeled an illegal, a fugitive, a criminal. He advertised in newspapers, "Come here to my house, rest your weary head and eat, and we will heal and clothe your bleeding body, and man's puny laws be damned." Jermaine Wesley Logan in this very city risked life and limb helping to free Jerry, the pounced upon runaway slave. After the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850 was passed, Logan, who by then was also an educator in barn stalls, basements, or cellars, always in the early black church, which also at that time could have been in barn stalls, basements, or cellars, He openly challenged here in this city of Syracuse its citizens and leaders to face the question of righteousness. Would they not stand for liberty and justice for all over the hellhounds of any slave catcher? He openly challenged the president of the divided states, divided over slavery. He dared President Fillmore or anyone to try and carry him back to slavery. After the Jerry rescue, and after he'd raised much Cain over freedom and everything Syracuse and America was supposedly about, he did again have to flee to Canada and wait for the dust to settle. Some dust has yet to settle, and we are yet again, or perhaps we always have been, the divided states of America, because some folk believed and some folk, many folk still believe this country, this city, this world was created by and for them alone, and anything else contrary to their wants and needs and greed, be damned. The good reverend's work is not finished. I have to pay tribute to the mother of this great man. I first learned about the Reverend Logan because he was part of my life, part of my church, I should say, in Binghamton, the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church. Anything in writing has him only being there for a short time, even though he was in and out of Binghamton and Montrose in that circle, being the circuit preacher. But we have him in our own very ledger of being and working, ushering people to freedom and preaching the Word of God in our church in Binghamton, New York, from the years of 1860 and 1868, in and out, back and forth. And when I first learned about the Reverend and his connection to my church and hopefully, I would like to believe, my own great-great-grandparents, I fell in love with him, and then I learned about his mother, and I fell in love with his mother and his daughter and the rest of the family. So I want to pay tribute to his mother. I'll think about you, Cherry, when I have the nerve to whine about not finding $40 for silk stockings and fake fingernails. I'll see you and be quiet. And when my tongue feels tired of chicken, or my hands think they're too weary to feed my family something that I've never had to chase and club or singe or pluck, I'll see you and get busy. Come whisper to me, Cherry, when I'm livid with my children, when they've gotten on my last nerve. Remind me how you watched yours being let off, bound and roped for sale. Then how gruffed hands cupped your screams and dragged you back across the dirt to string you up for lashes for having had the black audacity to chase after your children. I think about you rising up 4:30 every morning to never hold a paycheck in your scarred and unsoft hands. While I roll out from my comforts at 6 or 7:30, begrudging how I never get to lay there. Just lay there with the man I love, the man I chose to marry. And then I ponder you in passion. Did you ever get to lay down with someone because you wanted to? A laugh upon a pillow. Did you get to spill your secrets at his shoulder in the night? Though I don't rightly know if I should try to tell my sweetheart how you come around me, Cherry, and sometimes you bring your children, and you're all up in the corners, and you just won't go away. And it causes me to weep for days. Thank you.
This space with the story of Jermaine Logan. We I'm Dara, and I work with Olivia and Josh and Joanna on this project called Specters of Liberty. So I'm just going to do a quick introduction, and then we'll have the panelists come up. Just a little backstory on our project is the three of us met in Troy, New York, which was also an important site on the Underground Railroad. And we did this project that's being projected on the wall back there about Henry Highland Garnett, who was also a very important abolitionist preacher in Troy. And that's documentation from that project. So Olivia moved here, and she said, well, you know, there's some really important stories here that are being told in different spots, and we thought, well, you know, let's amp it up. So we contacted Kelly over at Community Folk Arts Center to see if we could, you know, do some collaboration, and they were interested. And so this is our project, and basically we have this space here for the next 3 weeks, and we started by looking at German Logan's life and his words. And we in that project too, you see we have Henry Highland Garnett's words. So we're looking a lot at words and stories and writing. And what Logan did is he declared, as articulated in the story as well, that Syracuse be an open city, a city in which you could advertise in the paper that you were going to house people escaping to freedom during the Fugitive Slave Act, which was a very, you know, there was not something you could do all over the place. You'd go to jail, basically. So, and these are his words, too, about the Fugitive Slave Act. So we decided we want to do another outdoor event, but instead of just doing our outdoor public event, we were going to have this space to get people together, talk about different ideas of the open city, like what could it mean today? Is his idea, what is Syracuse an open city today? What can you speak of? What can you not speak of here? And then just different issues. So we, you know, this is an experiment. We're in this process of you know, trying to make a public dialogue through this art space. And on our website, spectersofliberty.com, we have all the schedule. And tonight, as you know, you're here, you're going to learn about tonight because you're here. But tomorrow night at 7, we have a discussion about open movement. So what does it mean to be able to move or stay put? Which was, you know, a question that is brought up by the story of the Underground Railroad, but also today. What does that mean today for people who are restricted in their movement or restricted from staying where they would like to be? And Jenna Lloyd, who's actually here, she's organized tomorrow night's event, which will be with, I hope I don't mess up people's names, but Kefui Atta, Megan Chapman, Caroline Kim, Jenna Lloyd, and Allie Wayne will be speaking, and we'll have a discussion with them. The next day will be Open Options, is a discussion about civil rights, a different period and core in Syracuse, and there'll be a video screening, The Legacy of George Wiley, and a discussion with Kendall Phillips about that. Friday evening we'll have a party, which is not a discussion. it's an open house party. And then Sunday we're going to have a discussion. It's called Open Economy Ice Cream Social. And it's about the economies of upstate New York in terms of the prison economies. And, you know, talking and with a group called Free Families Rally for Emancipation and Empowerment, as well as a group called Milk Mat Jails, who are trying to look at, you know, dairy production upstate. And is that a viable economic alternative to the prison industrial complex? So in addition to that, I just have it, you know, it's a complex project, so I want to explain as much as I can about it. We're also collaborating with the art school, the art school run by Joanna Spitzner, right here. And there's a reading list on our website if you're interested in reading more about Germaine Logan and some of the ideas about the open city. And what else? There's also going to be daily, after this week, next week, if you would like to come in and get tape recorded and be put on Red House Radio and make videos about your ideas about what might make, if Syracuse is an open city and why, or what might make it more open, or your thoughts on any of the events, please talk to, Joanna's going to have a sign-up sheet over there, and we're going to be doing radio. And then the finale is on June 5th, unless there is a rain. We'll have a rain date the next day, which is an outdoor public event at the Life Sculpture Park, which is right about a half mile down the road here, which was actually the site, I don't know if Jack here, but in the 1850s, of a large abolitionist meeting of 5,000 people. That's why we made these buttons mm-hmm. for people will come out that night, and we'll hope to evoke the spirit of that time and think about today. And we're going to be having these large sculptures and projections that we're working on. They're in process, these zoetropes. So is there anything I forgot, anybody? Okay, so I just wanted to explain a lot of that stuff to you. Please take little pamphlet. I don't have any more left. Oh, arms out. About Logan and also buttons. So I'm very happy to continue this evening and introduce the speakers. Would they like to come up and find a seat?
Oh. Well, I think firstly it means the city has to be educated. Perhaps they don't know about the past. I was saying to Rachel, you folks are lucky. At least there's acknowledgement here in my area. Hence our organization, the Center for Anti-Slavery Studies in Montrose, Pennsylvania, just down the road from Binghamton. There was no acknowledgement, or very little acknowledgement, of the Underground Railroad, Reverend Logan, Harriet Tubman, any freedom finders passing through. So I would say, firstly, education. People aren't aware. Adults are not always aware, and unfortunately, young people often don't care.
Well, that's a good segue, because Rachel's executive director is saying, yes, it's all about education, is it not?
Ask that check.
I think, the open city is, and when we think about our children in the city, that we have, every kid in our school district, we have gifted and talented children. All of our children are gifted and talented. And to open up their minds and have them explore a city that really does unearth its history, really has access to giving them access to museums, really moving and igniting their intellectual curiosity. But I also say that in a city where our neighborhoods have been moved apart through the demolition of the 15th Ward, and I think that reverberates throughout our community. I-81 and Dr. Fullove was here most recently, and even if you look at South Salina Street, where we are right now, Armour Square and South Salina Street, the gatherings of folks and the inequality of this three blocks from South Salina to here is very dramatic and visible. So I think as a community, we also have to think about how we design our city for its openness to engage and create equality in that. If they move the bus stops on South Salina away from there, you will have no people walking up and down South Salina. And if you come here to Armory Square, you see predominantly white people in Starbucks and in other faith places. Mm-hmm. So I think that visual, and our kids feel that. They feel where they can walk, where they can't, what they can be a part of, what they can't be a part of, and they continuously experience that, and it's important for us to be mindful of it.
Okay. Yeah, my stance with regard to the framing open city starts from the fact that I'm a relative newcomer to the city. I've been here since fall 2007. I was here once before as a student about 20 years ago, but even then it wasn't an open city for me because I stayed on campus and I never really ventured to the city except for some small excursions with my graduate student association. So I really didn't know the city at that point, and I'm beginning to know it now. I'm still getting lost every once in a while, beginning to know it. So when the phrase was put before me, open city, I visualize it with a question mark at the end, and I typically start with things. I typically start by writing things out in order to sort of like figure out and get a grasp of what is it that I'm thinking about here. What's going on here? So. For me, I brought up some questions. I wrote open city as a question because openness implies choice. And I'm curious about even the framing of this particular event such that, you know, how many knew or know to participate in this and how... What the access is to the event, what the access is to being a part of this process of telling this story or telling stories. I'm thinking of this as an inauguration of an idea, and I like the fact that it begins the collaboration between Olivia Dura and the other gentleman. I forget Josh. Yeah. Because that's good, because you folks are beginning to share stories, now you're beginning to cull stories from the participants in the audience. I'm thinking about openness to identities, openness to visibility, something that Rachel just mentioned. Who's visible, or who will be at the end of this storytelling event, who will be visible and who will still be invisible, is my question. Is Syracuse open to figuring and reconfiguring? Is it open to reinterpretation? Is it open to reinterpreting itself? And this is a big question, obviously, because we're talking about many, many people. You know, this is starting with just a few of us here. So obviously, right from the start, there are other stories to be told, and we will probably never be able to tell all the stories to be told. I'm reminded of... a question that came to mind when I participated in some discussions on something called the connective corridor that is being built and planned here in Syracuse to try to make a connection between the university and the city. And the first question I had at the time, back to the theme of openness, was why isn't it called connective corridors? Why isn't it multiple pathways? And is it being built in such a way that it's a two-way corridor? You know, or a set of corridors. Once again, back to that notion of openness. And just going, and I'll just be careful of my airtime, I'll just say that when in thinking about the story that was just told about Jermaine Logan, the idea of openness suggests also an openness to choices. Because what he was doing was the moral choice. You know, if you go back to that Bible verse that says that everything is permissible, but not everything is beneficial, right? Mm-hmm. Are folks open to the most beneficial choices for the city at this time? And what is, and if not, what is impeding that, those moral choices? So I'll stop there.
I'm Kim from Outreach Gathering. like to think of the city of Syracuse as an open city. I guess, yeah, I think maybe it's not as much as we'd like it to be. I think we're a pretty small city, and I feel that it is, considering the size of us, I feel like we are a very segregated city. And what you're talking about, the neighborhoods, that where people go, and I think there is, the city definitely has a lot, like, university versus community aspect to it, that I think the university has been trying to, I think they understand that and are trying to address it, but we personally don't always think that they do the best job. Thinking of things like what's going to be happening in the West Side, the Narrow West Side Initiative, and if that project, how is that really going to affect that community there? I think it's being seen as a revitalization project, but I think some people in that community don't really feel like it's sort of, you know, maybe it's the university trying to improve itself and improve the image in that neighborhood, but not so much working with the people in that neighborhood. So I think that we have a lot of challenges there in the city. And I think also in the city, not just the city, I think realizing that how the city is just expanding far beyond the suburbs and what our relationship is with people living in the city and people that live in the city versus people that live in the suburbs. I think there's definitely an area to think of it as an open city of who has access to what. And so I think there it gets.
Contextualize the commentary, because I think what Brenda was talking about in terms of what students are interested in or what people are interested in, because it's about what they know. And I think what's very interesting when we're making this conversation about access and what some of the narratives about Syracuse being an open city, of which I would like to, you know, have you all sort of lay on the table if you're willing to take the risk. I think part of the issue is that we have to also understand the history of the city and the different populations in it, and how they've been able to either relate with each other or been able to by whatever you want to call it, the man, the government, the system. If you want to go any place, you still have to come downtown. And so, you know, if you have, you know, more than one child, or even one child, who wants to spend 3 hours to get to some place where, you know, it really takes 20 minutes if that bus would just cross town, as opposed to going downtown? And so there are a lot of things that sort of lay the foundation that really from which these attitudes emerge. And so one of the questions I really would like to ask our, what I'll now call break panelists, is to really talk about what are the narratives in this city, because we can't talk about this notion of openness unless we really start to just lay bare what the barriers or the conversations around the openness versus the closeness of the city, sort of like what you raised with perspectives regarding the Near West Side. I think that's with any neighborhood where university professors like myself and James, but not us, have gone in and utilized the community for our research, have gotten accolades, papers, etc., and they've said thanks very much and gone right back up the hill. And I really, you know, and there are lots of folks that are trying to change that, and I think you have a chancellor with Scholarship in Action that's trying to even rebrand it and talk about being conscientious and invested and not utilizing, or what I'd like to say, pimping out the community for your own personal gain. That's no longer the case, but that doesn't diminish the existing commentaries and discourses that are happening in terms of Syracuse and Oakland City. And so I'll start by even saying I think one of the challenges is someone who engages in community work that is absolutely committed but is not born and raised here, is that there are people in the city that exist in an inside or outside of relationship, and I feel like I'm one of those. I feel completely comfortable going into any community and having a conversation because I respect all forms of knowledges, but it is also made abundantly clear that I'm not born here. Mm. I'm a seventh generation New Yorker, but I'm from downstate. I might as well be from another planet. Because I didn't go through the school system here. And I know it's a sense of self-preservation out of a very real place. But the question then becomes, what are all the other narratives? Because until you own it and honor it, you can't ever come by it. You know, you can't move past it. And so, Brenda, I know you're from Binghamton, but I think that upstate New York sensibility is very similar in sense of the communities, particularly the communities of color down there. I spent one day in a courthouse, and I felt actually like I was watching a slave auction, because every single person that went up there was a black man who had done something. And it often wasn't significant, but it was enough to garner attention, get arrest, and stand there and have to declare that they're poor to get assistance, say publicly where they work, say whether they're employed or not. And the part that was so hard for me is that it also must have been bring your kids to work today. And there were two young white boys that were sitting at the prosecutor's table. And I'm sitting there going, I have to sit behind the bench. And these two little kids are just sitting there making notes. And the message that's being sent is profound. And so I'm wondering if you would even lay bare some of the narratives that are existing for the communities that you revolve in. I mean, just the sort of narratives, you know, what they're saying. What, you know, why is it not open? It's not open because, sort of like, at least I hear about Binghamton, is that if you're black in a particular neighborhood, you'll be arrested on site irrespective if you do anything wrong. Now, I know one may commit that to paper, but that's definitely one of those narratives that contradicts the notion of an open city.
Well, I would say that might be true. The radio station in Binghamton that carries Rush Limbaugh for 3 hours a day, they promote themselves by being very proud of the fact that the Binghamton Police Department listens to that every day for 3 hours a day while they're driving around on duty. So I think immediately there's closed-mindedness. There's not a lot of understanding.
What are some of the, I'm just going to try to keep moving just a little bit, but I hear your point. What about some of the other narratives? Maybe, Rachel, I know, given what you're doing with Say Yes, and you've met with a number of communities here, and I know they've been amazingly vocal about some of the challenges, not just in terms of what's happening with Say Yes, but just living in the city before and after Say Yes.
Yeah, you know, I think it's very hard for people to live out who they are, and a lot of the narratives or stories that are told is either not being seen, for example, as being college material, therefore not being approached to go to college, to talk about college. Even my previous, when I first moved to Syracuse, I used to work with folks to find jobs here in the city, and I had many of the guys get thrown down on the south side because the bus wouldn't come in time to take them to work. So they'd walk, and they'd walk from the south side out to Carrier Circle. And then they'd lose their job because they weren't there on time, and there was all of this continuous, you know, blame, and it was always, they're just not good employees, and they were remarkable employees and remarkable people. I think the stories of our kids from, if we listen, we have a global community. We have children from around the world. From Sudan, from the Congo, from Burma, from Iraq, Latino folks. We have folks that leave, families that leave at Seymour School every year to go back to their home in Puerto Rico. We don't acknowledge, we look at speaking multiple languages in public education as a deficit and not as an asset, and that many of our young people, all of our young people should speak multiple languages. We live in a global society. I see many of our kids who are refugee students, who was a part of an after-school program. They're up at Hendricks Chapel, this is before Say Yes, speaking. In that room we had 14 different languages that were spoken. And we really created an international global learning community. And then I would see the kids in special ed classes when they were placed in school. And I said, how can this be? They can manipulate snack in 4 different languages. They can get extra snack in 4 different languages. And you tell me they belong in special ed? So, I mean, I can go, but the stories, and the kids, you know, we had, I'll give you an example of one of the playgrounds was vandalized last summer, and our kids were very vocal about that. They said, well, we're not going to let this happen, and they wanted to rebuild their playground. And so second graders wanted to be heard about that and what they want and what they feel and what things are happening. And how can they be a part of that? So I think that there's a lot of different...
Well, not only did they do that, though, but the other second graders in other schools responded by doing fundraisers.
That's right. They were together as a community.
Right, it was inspired by children as opposed to adults saying, don't you think it's a good idea? They knew it was the right thing to do, and they just did it on their own. And even if it was $20, it was such an honor for them to be able to support who they considered their peers that they never even met. In this notion of openness that we're trying to really wrap our heads around and then talk about.
As I said before, one of the things that's, I didn't say this. There was a refrain that you kept on mentioning in the story, where it was, I made a note of it, the idea that this is a great country for me and for me alone.
Some folk believe
that. Right?
The country was made by me and for them.
But for them and for them alone. And it struck me that... that's because they have a particular story and they're not sharing in other people's stories, because everyone has that same story, has a similar story about what this country means to them. And so I'm in a position where I want to hear more about the stories that are here in the city. And I know for sure that the arts and arts practices are a means for conveying stories. They're a vehicle for conveying stories. And so one of the things that I'm interested in as an art, as a former elementary school art teacher and as someone who's involved in arts education is figuring out ways to create a greater access to the arts as a storytelling medium for folks who think that they're artists, but for anyone, for folks who don't necessarily think that they're artists at all. But to get back to your question about stories here, the one thing that I do hear of pretty regularly is a set of stories that are connected with the Southside Innovation Center. My wife works in connection with that center. This particular city reminds me very much, very certain neighborhoods of the city remind me of the neighborhood that I grew up in, Brooklyn. One of the things they didn't have in my neighborhood, though, was a center like the South Side, you know, an initiative like that where people who had entrepreneurial ideas for creating access for themselves, right, where it doesn't exist, creating a particular pathway for themselves, could have an opportunity to begin to work on it in their own little cubicle space, begin to get together, plan, strategize, and come up with an idea. And that, to me, is about people generating, making themselves visible, making their ideas visible. And these are adults, but I'd like to suggest that and that's something I was talking about with just a little bit earlier today, that students, young people, have ideas that are worthwhile, mind knowing something about. and my paying attention to and attending to their story, their idea, their, you know, is their piece. But if I'm not, if I'm not in a position where I'm willing to hear it, or where they have the opportunity to share it, then we have that divided city again. You know, we have that place where there are invisible dreams and invisible ideas, and that we need to have a little bit less of that. You know, so my vote is for trying to, and my effort has been to try to create more avenues to the arts.
Well, I just wanted to, because as James was talking, I just wanted to share this story about when I first came to Syracuse 12 years ago, I was asked to give a talk to second graders about stress before a test. So, of course, I thought, what am I going to do, sing a song, stand on my head? I don't know. And, you know, I went in to talk to the teachers, and I had come from the Boston area. I had come from living in Roxbury, which is a predominantly African-American community, and I was talking about how, but I didn't use any, I didn't say that I didn't tell the faculty where I had been. Well, I told them I was in Boston, but I didn't say, oh, the kids were poor, they were inner city, or whatever, you know. I just said, you know, I had kids building cars with physicists and racing them down the Charles River. We brought the trolley cars into Roxbury, and actually now the trolleys are part of the tour of the city of Boston to learn about the Underground Railroad and the Frank Lloyd Garrison home and so forth. Talked to, and they didn't know who that was, so. But and talked a lot about all of the kids publishing and creating their own. And this group of second grade teachers raised their hand, or they said, well, that's great. I must have worked really well in a white suburban school, but it would never work for our kids here. Mm. And I mean, that's second grade. So if you're making those decisions in you know, you think that way in second grade. I mean, I almost, you know, drove my car into a tree on the way home. I was so furious because it's just, I get that mad.
Yeah.
Because, we call them wows. You're like, and the thing is that it doesn't need to be a wow. Kids can do that. Kids can, you have high expectations, they reach them. And they were doing things that were three grade levels above, and therefore, lo and behold, they were able to pass all the state exams because their abilities were far beyond rote learning and not being able to.
Well, can I just say something real quickly there? I mean, one of the problems there was that these teachers were imposing a story on these youngsters.
Right.
If you impose a story and don't listen to the stories that come back, right? Ultimately, if you have too few stories, well, all you have left is stereotypes. So there's this stereotype of the troubled inner city youth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, isn't it? If you don't know, if you haven't heard the story of a particular youth, you may find out that someone who lives in the inner city is not troubled at all, and they are. If you talk about someone who's being underserved, maybe this particular youth is very well served by his parent and by his church, very well served, and it's going to get and be just fine, right? But but one of the problems that we tend to have is the imposition of a story that is easy, right? And allows us to miss the particularities and the possibilities that this story can diverge in any number of ways, right? So,
I mean, I was just thinking there's a difference between an institutional story
and
a vernacular story, and especially in Syracuse, because I don't know, the institutional stories are probably like SU, typical, Irish and Italian American, but the city actually, I mean, this is a progressive center, if you think about it, Gage and Logan, and Peace Council was founded in 1936, and I think, or you think of the neighborhoods in the city. I mean, it's a poor city.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big divide between it's a few big institutions, and then there's everyone else.
Right.
I did some work on the 15th Ward,
oral history, and the stories are amazing.
Yeah.
And they're beautiful, and they're sad, and there's differences between how people perceived it, and how they experienced it. And so some of it is about, like, letting people feel proud of their story. And the city maybe doesn't recognize it enough, you know, what we really are. You know, we're not what the normal is. Oh, the other progressive, you know, the Onondaga Nation is amazing. You know, and that's always part of
I think the term
but we never embrace it.
Yeah, I think I went to a meeting. I think they said that Syracuse had a self-esteem problem. I think that was that collectively that we have a collective self-esteem problem, which made me laugh and then felt remarkably familiar. You know, because I was like, and I'm like, wow, because I don't know if you've ever noticed, but when you talk to someone and you tell them you're from Syracuse, at some point the word "I'm sorry" somehow emerges. Usually around weather, but still, at some point, an apology emerges from somebody's mouth. It is such an interesting phenomenon. I don't apologize about being from Long Island or coming from Connecticut, but when there's this conversation or someone relocates, I mean, when we bring people in, they'll often say, "I told someone I moved here," and then they apologize to them. And I thought, well, what an interesting perspective about one's own self-worth that somehow you feel like you need to apologize for what may or may not occur, or and you know, I feel like the response should be for what. But the move is always to sort of justify and explain and situate oneself, which I don't find in many other cities, and I'm completely fascinated by it because I don't know where it came from. Johanna, to talk about the institutional perspective in terms of open and closed, I remember when I first came to Syracuse, first of all, I didn't know upstate New York was still New York, being from Long Island. I thought it stopped at, like, New Rochelle. And then I didn't know there were farms. You know, I remember looking at my mom and saying, wow, there are plows and tractors. And, I mean, it was just unbelievable. But what I did like when I got here is that the university was open. You drove around the corner and you went right on campus. And then you went around the corner and you went on South Campus. And the longer I stayed, the more guard booths came up. I mean, we get displaced when there's a basketball game. You know, but you don't stop taking the parking fee out of my check. You don't say, here's a reimbursement because you can't park these 3 days because there are games. So it's this notion of choice that we keep talking about, or the illusion of choice. You know, pick your parking lot. Well, none of them matter on certain days. You can't pick anything. It's the illusion of choice. And it's notion of being a part of but still being reminded that you're not quite a member of. And I remember when they were talking about guard booths, the notion was that they were keeping the element out. And by the time they finished building the last one, they realized they had actually walled the element in. Because some of the biggest drug dealers, actually, we went to school with them. You know, anything you wanted, they were visiting the people that you were going to school with. They weren't coming up from the neighborhoods, which was the story. So if you believe the story, you perpetuated the story. And then, you know, and of course, it's that sort of one of a time, you know, if one major crime happens, you know, people jump on it, and then it becomes symbolic for an entire community or an entire gender. But yet, the folks that you actually walled in were the ones that had created, you know, small businesses, doing things, you know, street pharmaceuticals, et cetera. I mean, these institutions that had now been walled in. And you know, I think only now are they beginning to realize that, you know, the element was the element they recruited, you know, and what the element looked like wasn't what they expected. It didn't fit the profile. And I think it's about dismantling those understandings. I think one of the most recent and shocking things happened to me not too long ago. Our students were involved in a really bad accident, and the driver, who is my second mother, was injured, and she was put in the back of an ambulance. She's Oneida. I'm African American, but I'm also Shinnecock, but visibly I'm African American. And I remember knocking on the door of the ambulance saying, "That's my mom. Can you open the door?" And I only found out later, the woman in the ambulance said, "She can't be your daughter. She's black. She's darker than you. She can't be your kid." Because it's being videotaped, I'm not going to tell you what she said back. But what I can say, she said, "Please open those doors." But, you know, part of it was, you know, my family comes in all colors. But it's that notion about what the expectation is versus who, you know, what you look like, what that means you should be, and who you are and who's open, kind of like Rachel's talking about in terms of young men even trying to get the bus to get to work. And so when we talk about open and close, we need to really sort of think about those things. Now, as you can tell, we have the gift for gab.
I do want to add one thing quick.
Sure.
Kelly, is that I do want to talk about this retainer wall at the university, though. There's a wall that was painted orange and blue, and it's down by Dr. King School. And one day I got out to take a photograph because it said rich people only on it in graffiti. And so there was this conversation going on, is did the community residents write it or did university students write it? Mm-hmm. And it's painted over now. Mm-hmm. But it was the time teaching a community organizing mm-hmm. course, and was sort of saying how we build up walls and talking about the parking booths and so on and so forth. But and it was an interesting dialogue around that particular and what that message is and what is, you know, and who's writing the message and what's the ongoing town gown dialogue that's going on. Mm-hmm. A side story to that is not long after that guy pulls up and he says, well, can I have $5 because my car's out of gas? And I said, John, you don't have a car, you want to ride? And he said, okay, Rachel. I said, but did you see the new wall? He goes, yeah, who do you think wrote it? You know? Right. So we drove by together and I took him to where he needed to go. But it's interesting. I mean, mm-hmm. And sometimes when people are getting their messages out, they use graffiti because they're not invited into the mainstream.
Well, you said you were willing to learn. I see or hear the other story or another story. That you're open to that. Well, to many people, it doesn't occur to them that there is another story.
There's another story.
And there are multiple dialogues. I saw one hand because I like to go ahead and open it up if we could.
Like, you know, it's not going to work, we're going to tear it down, this and that, and like there is no engagement from the community. There is so much on newsletters and newsletters, but me as an outsider that I was part of the program, I don't see anything. So there's a lot of dislocation between those two communities.
I'll tell you one of the best community design projects that I've seen, and it's interesting because these folks from Scotland came to see how we do things here, which is sometimes probably a mistake. But because they had one of the best designs, and I also saw this in the Roxbury community, is they actually put the models out, and community residents came through. And on pieces of paper, they wrote down what they wanted to see in their neighborhoods, and every day somebody recorded that, so that for a period of over a month and a half, the kids would come and they'd say, I want a playground, and parents would come and say, I want this, this, and this. And then at the end, there was a community meeting so that everybody's input was a part of it, and then folks could say, this is what's possible that we can do within the financial means of what this is, and this is, so that you have everybody's voices heard. And I think sometimes we don't design engagement. We put committees together, or you have community groups, but you don't have representation. So in the end, in Roxbury, they reversed eminent domain. Mm-hmm. And the community actually owned the lots. Mm-hmm. And then they decided what needed to be built in each of those lots. And it was a really collective process. And it takes a lot of time and engagement, but people's voices are heard, and you really get a model. And then in the end, they set up a voting structure. So the Cape Verdean population had a vote, the African American community had a vote, and there was representation, and there was a youth vote. Mm-hmm. And having youth be invested in also what the design and so forth looks like. And so I think that it's, and also I think there's also folks who've done things before, and it may not be accepted, your work may not be accepted now, but 2 years from now somebody may say, yeah, that's the perfect plan. Right. I always think about Dr. Charles Willey when he tells me he did this whole bus desegregation plan for North Carolina, and someone threw it in a file cabinet. And 5 years later, this is the best plan I've ever seen. So you never know what might happen to your work.
Yes?
Good question. So with all the stories, some of the individual stories that you're telling, what kind of venues or spaces do you think are around for this kind of two-part question? So for having those stories be present, and then two, what are some strategies that you think are for hearing or seeing? I mean, you're talking about not being able to hear stories, or that some people's stories are part of being invisible, to become invisible. What are some strategies that you see for making things visible that are invisible, or hearing things that are unheard?
Legal or illegal?
Either way, in this context.
Well, do you know what I mean? Because I think some of the strategies that we would employ probably would be pretty illegal. I mean, it makes me think of the Public Art Commission when we tried to have something put on display, and they said if it had words, we couldn't, because legally in this town it was an advertisement. I thought, are you kidding? You're telling a bunch of ours? I mean, what, really? It didn't make any sense to me. And so, I mean, by virtue of even doing that, you then violate the law. And so that's where I'm saying whether it's legal or illegal, because I think that to put it in places that cross boundaries makes the most sense. I know that many, many years ago, CFAC had a Black History Month competition where we had students enter, and the winner would have bus wraps. Mm. And that was the only bus that year that was never vandalized.
Right.
And it was because it was the kids' work.
Right.
But it crossed boundaries. I mean, it went to every single neighborhood. Do I think Central would do something like that today? I don't know. But I think anything that crosses boundaries, whether it's the cars that we're driving, what's that really cool rainbow car that's on campus?
The Fag Block.
The Fag Block, excellent. Every time you see it, it stops people, they talk about it, but wherever you drive it generates discourse. You know, and I think those are the sort of things that you need to do. Sometimes you have to be interventionist and confrontational and unapologetic, for God's sakes.
Well, even as you say that, I'm looking at this sign, I don't respect this law, I don't fear it, I won't obey it. the words of Logan, right?
Right.
You know, the model that Rachel just mentioned was a very powerful one, because a map of an area is really a story, and a story is also a map that we follow, right? So that the idea that this particular model or map of this particular area was allowed to be reinterpreted by everyone who came by, right, made it a shared story, mm-hmm. right? And that's how you begin to break through that factionalism, those divisions between folks. Mm-hmm. Because I've seen situations where neighborhoods didn't interact with one another, because Brooklyn's like that too, where once you cross the street, you're in another neighborhood, you're not supposed to go there. And then someone built a new recreation center that straddled a couple of different street line division lines, and so because people now had to play together or interact with each other, all of a sudden it became a shared story. This was our center, and it crossed boundary lines. So that goes back to what you were just saying about finding a way to cross those lines, to be kind of transgressive.
That's where I think art plays a valuable role that we don't think about. As an artist myself, I'm more interested in maybe rules are, you know, like trying to bring it really more just like how I live, you know. So, but like that, those kinds of engagements instead of having a town hall hearing meeting. I mean, I think artists. And I'm really not trying to privilege artists, but like, you know, or creativity in general, which is not being taught as well in schools, you know, because we're busy in math and science, but that's where there's a lot of boundary crossing can happen. Mm-hmm. Art's also funny because in some ways it's accessible to everyone, in other ways it's completely inaccessible.
Because they're rendered invisible.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? The artist can enter any space. And if you do something insane, they say, oh, it's because you're an artist.
Right.
If you do something really amazing, it's all because you're an artist. And so you sort of have this free pass to respond in any way, shape, or form.
But any kind of art making is about kind of like understanding like what are the rules and how am I playing with these, whether it's like what are the rules of a material, or what are the rules about graffiti and how can I get away with that? You know, like, so I think that's where, and again, not trying to privilege it, but there's something that can be contributed in that sense, you know. And I'd actually like to see art game, you know, stop playing with paint, let's go out and try to figure out these borders and neighborhoods and do things.
Well, to answer your question, Olivia, I think one immediate thing I could think is that if everyone had one of these signs and then made five of them and gave them to five people that said that they would put it up either in the back of their car or literally on their front window, and then they had to get five people to do the same thing, eventually someone would be like, "What? You know, why is this everywhere and what is it saying?" And then that's an opportunity to have that conversation. Mm-hmm. You know, because I think sometimes, you know, it's the subtlety that often can generate the largest response. I mean, that could happen immediately. I mean, that's more work for Josh, unless he can get a whole bunch of art. But do you know what
get
I mean? Get some helpers. But it's that kind of thing. It's that kind of thing. I mean, I know Art Rage does a lot of those sort of things. I remember when Rose's windows were broken and she sent that one email around. I mean, CFAC immediately jumped up. We put on our t-shirts, we made our little signs that said straight but not narrow, and we put it up because we knew it was an important collaboration. It's important to say, you know, we're all one big creative family and we won't tolerate any of this.
Should I tell that story?
Sure, please.
It's a good response to it. So at our gallery last summer, someone like graffitied some homophobic words in response to a poster we had in the window. And we got this kind of amazing response of people saying, so I think what it said was, like, there's no such thing as a proud queer or something like that. And then we got a response of people holding, photographs of people holding up signs that say, like, I'm a proud queer, I'm a proud ally. And within, like, 48 hours, I think we got, like, 400 responses or something. So it was, and then we were able to hang all these pictures in the window. And so just like an amazing response of solidarity. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. That's a way to turn around a negative story.
It speaks to the potential. It speaks to the potential. You know, it does. Anybody? I know there are other folks in the audience that might have a question or comment.
Sure.
Okay, you said an open city. If we have an open city, I feel that you would have to go back from the early part of the city and find out all the history of your city. Now, to me, Syracuse is a wonderful town. I used to come here and about 20 years ago, and I used to deal with the community center. We used to coordinate programs together from Binghamton, Ithaca, Elmira, and we used to have a gathering. Back then it was lovely because everybody lived together, and 75% of the people that were here, most of them was from the South. And see, this is, I think, the problem is that you have to first find out the basis of who was here to have an open city. The other thing is that you talk about communities. We talk about communities breaking up, but we haven't talked about the main part of the city, that is the urban renewal, that sits there, that controls your plans 5 years down the road, and what you're doing now, they have already set up their plans. So they can have meetings, they can bring everybody in to talk about it, but down the road, it's already been set. In Binghamton, I'll give you an example. In Binghamton, that is called Susquehanna Street. Susquehanna Street in Binghamton was all in black on one end, and Italians on the other end. What they did through the urban renewal, they did not mess with the Italians, but they broke up the black community. How? If you say to a black community, I give you $30,000 for your house, and you move out, we'll put in new projects, and you'll be the first one to, get these houses. But it don't work that way. So I think the major thing that you have to do is find out what City Hall is doing. And with an open city, you go back to the basics. And I think, then you can see plans that have been made that you have nothing to do with. That's why I say if you have a historical center, go to them, find out all your, all the old people, all the new people, what went on in the city before, then you'd be over.
That's what happened at Community Folk Arts Center. We moved to a new location because it was right across the parking lot from Kennedy Square. And we were excited because it was just a community full of young people interested in the arts. And within a year, they had demolished the entire neighborhood. Completely gone. So all the kids that we thought we'd be serving, which is exactly why we moved there, were gone. And we tried to go as far up the food chain as we possibly could, at least from the university perspective. And it was as if nobody knew. I mean, so it's even who are the knowledge bearers. I mean, the assumption is if you're in City Hall, you know as much as I know. It's a very small group of people, which keeps that open city not so open, and that's one of the challenges. Is there anybody else that, yes?
Yeah, hello. My name is Kelmisha Gibbons, and I just wanted to point out I'm a Syracuse native here, born and raised. I'm a recent graduate of Howard University, so Howard alum, and I came back as well, and that is very rare. But I just wanted to point out that I think it's very important for us to engage our youth in the redevelopment of the community as well. I work with Hillside Work Scholarship Connection, and I'm also a member of the Southside Community Coalition. I'm chair of the cultural committee where we just developed a youth group. And the name of the youth group is the Southside Community Youth Group. And our mission is to restore, revitalize, and rejuvenate the Southside area. What better way to do that without the youth? They're going to be here even when some of us retire and move to Atlanta or wherever we may move, and they're going to keep it going. They'll be able to go back into the books and say, hey, I remember when this was planned. They'll be our new leaders. And I think that we just need to start engaging them. Some of them should be here today. Some of them should be listening to what we're saying. Some of them should have say in whatever it is that we're trying to do. We tend to look at them and say, they're kids, they don't know any better, but they're the ones who are being affected within the community. They're the ones who are on the corners. I believe if we give them
more things to be involved in, we'll less likely see them in the streets. You know mm-hmm. what I'm speaking based on where I come from. Like I said, I was born and raised here, urban city area. You know, both of my parents were in prison. Father did 11 years in prison. My mother did 6.5 years in prison. I put my own self through college. Mm-hmm. So I know, you know, I know exactly how it is. And when I look at these youth, I see me. Mm-hmm. I'm like, wow, you know, that's me. That's who I used to be. And a lot of people look at me and they don't see that. So when I share that, people are like, wow, are you serious? Yeah, I have a story too. I think we all have a story. Mm-hmm. But what it is that we need to try to, we need to try to grab them while they're kids mm-hmm. and put them inside of whatever it is that we're trying to do. Teach them, educate, even though we're teaching them in school or we're educating them in school, educate them about the different community activities that we're involved in too, what's going on in their community. A lot of them think that this is the only thing that's going on is out here in the street, you know, to sell drugs or to fight. That's all that they see. But they don't see that the Southside Community Coalition is out here trying to make a difference because they're not engaged in that. So I think that's the perfect thing for us to do is say, hey, let's get 4 or 5 youth, you know, 10 or 15, and have them join in on conversations that we're having. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they just need to hear and see and be a part of what it is that we're doing. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to point that out.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I was invited to speak to go into one of the alternative schools in Binghamton mm-hmm. and speak about the Underground Railroad, about the history of the African Methodist Church, and where our first building was, which is now Columbus Park. Those children, it was a plan to firstly get the children interested in history, take the children who were interested in art. They went out to the park. They were able to put graffiti and paint a picture of the church, their interpretation of the Underground Railroad and the things that used to take place there in the park, which is now, as of late, the last many years, the park has had a bad reputation, and supposedly it's an undesirable place to be, supposedly. So this plan with the alternative school, it really engaged the children, perhaps for the first time, being interested in history. Mm-hmm. And they got to express themselves through art. And then some of the other ones went a step further. They were able to produce a movie. Mm-hmm. And they take the whole project, the painting, the whole project, and it was quite an endeavor. Mm-hmm. And I do believe some of the children are still interested in art and history based upon that experience.
Mm-hmm. Is there anyone else that has any additional comments? I just have one last one, and it's to speak to your point, which I think, oh, sorry, go ahead, Josh.
No,
which I think is very valid, but one of the things that I find with Community Folk Arts Center is that we have an after-school program that engages youth. But the trick is to engage families, because families in the city aren't being engaged. I mean, largely when parents are called in the city, it's because their child has done something mm-hmm. wrong. I cannot tell you the struggle we have to invite them to something wonderful that their kid has done.
Mm-hmm.
Or when you raise the bar of expectation. And so although I think it's absolutely valuable and critical that young people are involved, I think if we continue to just involve kids without their parents, how they define parents and guardians and people that are caring for them, irrespective of their circumstances, the cycle just continues, right? Because I'm engaged as a young person. I turn 18, I get a job, and then nobody else wants to talk to me about anything, but they'll talk to my kid, and so on and so forth. And we need to start looking at more than just engaging those youth, but having them reach back and bring that parent or bring that guardian, because for us, that's the biggest thing that we see. That's where the barriers are finding, and that's what I'm even getting feedback from people that are working in the schools, because that's the only time parents are reached out to. And I think it'll be a great sea change, because if you involve these folks that feel displaced in their own neighborhood, and that the only time they are engaged with is to either come get their child or to be told their child has done something,
yes,
they'll respond differently. You won't get a PTA if you're only going to call me telling my child did in a way that's condescending and demeaning. I'm going to show up, but I'm not showing up to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm showing up for a different kind of conversation. And what that does is perpetuate a stereotype, even if your reasons are completely valid. So it's that collective sea change that we have to engage in. Josh, we'll give you the last comment, and then we'll wrap up.
I
kind of wanted to switch gears a little bit.
Sure.
Because, I mean, I don't live in Syracuse. I'm going to be here for 3 weeks. It's really been interesting and insightful, and I have a lot of amazing notes from things people have said. But I guess I want to shift maybe a little bit from the inside to the outside. That one of the things that, while we were sort of thinking through how to do this project, was really profound to me about Logan's words and his idea of the open city was its sort of insistence on the local being the national, being the international. And that it seems that at this moment today, we live in a country where literally walls are being built right. to separate us from other nations. And we have a federal agency, ICE, immigration services, that is functionally kidnapping people and bringing them back to their supposed point of origin, even though some of these people actually have no connection to the places that they're being dumped. And to me, there's an immense resonance in what is going on today with that and what Logan was dealing with in the middle of the 19th century. And I was wondering if anyone had any commentary about that and what role Syracuse or any city in this country could maybe play or conceptualize or build community relations and power to address those issues.
Well, this is one of the cities where it happens. Mm-hmm. This is where when you go to the bus station, when my 6-foot-tall dreadlocked Haitian American son goes to the bus, I say, make sure you have your ID. Because mm-hmm. how do you prove that you're from here if you're from here? Mm-hmm. But you look international, which is the situation. Every time he comes from Chicago, he says, when the train stops here, the state troopers walk through. And they literally just look at you. They look at everybody. And if they think you look like you don't belong here, they immediately question you and ask you for your documents. And if you're from here and you're a college student, you have a student ID, which is not a valid piece of ID. And so, we've heard of students that are from here that have been brought off and put in a detention center, but they're from here, and have their life completely disrupted. And mm-hmm. at the same time, though, I see people protesting. I've gone to the train station a number of times and seen people protest and really sort of speak out, but it's also not really spoken of collectively. And I think largely because it deals around immigration, and it's mm-hmm. considered somebody else's issue, because you may not necessarily be related. You don't understand that you could be next.
That's right.
Given the right look.
That's right.
And so I hear what you're saying. So that local becomes international, but the point is, how are people responding? And that I don't, I only see a little bit of.
Last month, my graphic designer was deported back to Venezuela. And she was a student who was here at the University. Her family has been in the U.S. for 14 years. And everybody had to go back to Venezuela. And it's just ghastly. Families have built their lives here and have done nothing for no reason, have got to return to,
Part of the problem is that this country has a long history of that.
Right.
All the time.
Yes.
At the same time, I think it has to happen in places like Syracuse. Like, if this city can get it together mm-hmm. and really, it's cities this size and beyond that have to really start saying, no, this is not a society we want to live in. Mm-hmm. We're a city that welcomes in like thousands of refugees a year, yet we, this is also a site where immigrants are important. Mm-hmm. And we need to reconcile that.
Mm-hmm. Can I add to that?
Sure.
This is a city that has a long history of being a sanctuary city the sanctuary movement from the 1980s of welcoming in and sheltering refugees illegally, so actively breaking. And then that has continued on. And so then, for instance, after September 11th, the city passed, people organized to try and get the city council to pass ordinances saying that they wouldn't abide by the Patriot Act provisions as well in terms of all of the rounding up of South Asian and Muslim people that was going on, still going on. So I think that that's another of the sort of like lineages of, that we can think about in terms of Open City that, that people continue to try and foster here. That's so amazing.
So, any last words from the panelists or anyone from the audience that would like to contribute before we bring it to a close? Well, I would like to encourage for all of you that have spoken or those that you haven't that you go over and sign up and share your words with everyone. Joanna. Mm-hmm. Thanks, everyone.
Another very quick poem, and then I would like you all to join me and interact interactively with a old spiritual. And this was a song called "Oh Freedom," often sang at the burial time of a person of color. But first, I wanted to share this word on tolerance. And I wish they, whoever they are, would change some terminology when speaking of what ought to be naturally occurring good behavior and respectfulness towards any individual as in human being, a human being created, no one's permission needed. While clearly ethnic cleansing sounds as though somebody must be dirty, this thing tolerance sounds like someone is being done a favor, or worse, bestowing one a favor. And though perhaps some might believe it's being mighty thoughtful, who wants to be tolerated? Oh, freedom. Oh, oh, freedom. Oh, freedom, over me. And before I'd be a slave, I'll be dwelling in my grave, and I'll go home to my Lord and be free. Sing with me, no more weeping. No more weeping, no more weeping, no more weeping over me. And before I be a slave, I'll be dwelling in my grave, and I'll go home to my Lord and be free.